We are finally back with the Drive and Kick podcast. I know people have been asking me, when's it coming back? When's it coming back? The real answer was that I was busy grading finals from the semester that I just had teaching at Boston University. But the other answer is that I wanted to start the show off with someone important, someone who could bring the gravitas of to talk about the league in a really deep and meaningful way. And so I got Scott Cassiola of the New York Times, unfortunately. No, I'm just kidding. Scott Cassiola, one of the fine writers covers the NBA. Moving on to a slightly different venture we're going to talk about. But first, Scott, how are you today?
I'm great. How many people were unavailable before you got to me?
Like six.
That's actually low. I thought it'd be more.
No, I'm teasing. I'm teasing. Look, you begged me for like a year to come on this podcast.
That's exactly right. More than a year.
Right. So, okay, we're going to do this another time. And so for you people listening out there, we actually recorded like 10 minutes of this and totally got lost to the sounds of time. So we're going to go over some territory we just talked about, but hopefully it'll sound fresh to you.
10 minutes, so I'm glad we can do it over again.
There are always do-overs on the internet, Scott. Always do-overs. Okay, so we got to start here because yesterday your employer, the New York Times, made a funny, and that's not something we normally associate, not very Timesian of them, where they basically said the Knicks are killing you and they're taking you off the beat. So was this a joke or is this for real? What are you doing?
It is for real. I will clarify.
Please.
We're not stopping our coverage of the Knicks. I think that was what the people who freaked out about this. It was actually a pretty small percentage. I think most people thought it was, I don't know, maybe not clever, but interesting or funny. You know, I've been sharing Nick duties this season with Andrew Kay, my fine colleague. Anyway, we've kind of been splitting it up because the state of New York professional basketball is not so great, and there's not a ton of interest in the Nets, and they've been struggling until recently anyway. So he's been kind of divvying it up, and Andrew is, sure enough, Andrew today is in D.C. with the Knicks, so we're covering them. We haven't stopped. This was largely, honestly, a great opportunity for me to kind of get off the beat for a couple of weeks and see some good basketball. We solicited suggestions from readers on if there are good stories, you know, any level, grade school basketball, college basketball, the NBA, what they might want to read about. There are interesting people doing interesting things. So I'm going to go out and find some good stories, a lot of it based on what readers suggest we go out and write about. So I think part of the philosophical part of this was, I think in New York, we've been so accustomed to losing basketball. The Knicks are not very good. The Nets have historically been awful, dating back to when they were in New Jersey. So the idea is to get out and see teams that win and see if there are common threads between, you know, a fifth grade girls team in Illinois and the Warriors, maybe. You know, what are the similarities? How do they approach the game? So it'll be a lot of fun. I think it's something different and pretty, you know, it's not exactly like I'm a Knicks beat writing veteran, so I feel a little bit guilty about that. But I'll take the opportunity if I can get it.
Right. I mean, Howard Beck has got to be just killing himself right now because he had to sit there through like 7 years of Isaiah Thomas madness and never got this shot. You were on the beat for like what, a year, if that?
A year and a couple of months, I guess.
You're so soft.
I actually do. That's what I feel guiltiest about is Howard, because I think he tweeted something yesterday like, "Where was this opportunity in 2006, or 2007, or 2008?" He was stuck with this team forever. So I do feel that. So Howard, I apologize. Let's go together. I want to take Howard with me on this trip. Speaking of him.
Beck can steady himself with all that fine Bleacher Report work that he's doing these days. We love Howard. Howard's one of our guys. But this is an interesting concept because, you know, I grew up in North Jersey and with the Knicks. And a little bit of the Nets, too. Sort of like, you know, my black sheep basketball association is those 80s and 90s New Jersey Nets. But, you know, the Knicks in the Patrick days, they were a lot of fun. And the New York fan, The Knicks fan has been credited with being one of the smartest fans in the league. They grew up on the great Red Holtzman teams of the 70s. But, like, man, we're going back really far if we're still associating the Knicks with the early 70s in terms of winning basketball and even the 80s. I mean, it's been a long, long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's been pretty rough. They had that one 2012-2013 when they went to the playoffs. That seems so long ago, though, doesn't it? I mean, they won 54 games that year and went to the playoffs, and Mari was healthy and everything was great. They're just falling completely apart. One of the interesting things to me is how the Hawks and the Knicks basically finished last season with identical records. And now look at what the Hawks have done since then, and look at where the Knicks are. I mean, that's one of the more amazing things to me about sort of team building, is how the Hawks have sort of engineered this slow growth and development, and they've really taken off, and the Knicks are just, it's a fire sale at this point. They're dumping whatever they can and starting over fresh.
Right, and the Hawks really didn't do much this offseason. I mean, the big thing is getting Al Horford back, which is not a small thing. He's a really, really good player. But this is basically the same team they had last year, same coach, same everything.
Yep.
And it just, you know, there's something to be said for patience. I'm not sure how far they can take that.
Exactly. I think continuity in the NBA is sort of an overlooked. It's not maybe as valued as it should be. I mean, clearly the Spurs have great players, but there's a team that has continuity. You look at what the Cavs tried to do this season. It doesn't happen immediately. You can't just combine really good players and expect the system to work. I love what the Hawks are doing because it's just team basketball. They run really good plays. These are guys who are really familiar with each other. Maybe they don't have the most sort of top end talent as a lot of teams, but they make it work, and it's kind of refreshing in a lot of ways to see this, see a team like that really, really work.
No, it really is. And, you know, I think people had an expectation that because Phil Jackson's imprint was going to be on this team, that they were going to see, you know, something similar, maybe not with the talent level, but like a cohesive basketball unit. And I haven't seen that at all, really.
Yeah, it's been really tough. I mean, they've been, injuries have not been kind to this team, although I'm getting feedback again on the phone. I apologize.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yep. No problem.
Okay. I think injuries have taken sort of a toll on this team. Carmelo's out with a knee injury again, but they weren't even playing that well before this all kind of, before he went out. I mean, the interesting thing in terms of team building, I mean, this really is going to be a lost year, because how many of these guys are going to be back next season? Two or three? I think they have four guys under contract for next season remaining on the roster at this point after Monday's deal. So, I mean, if you're talking about sort of installing triangle and having guys understand a quote-unquote complicated system, they're going to be starting over again next year with a new set of players that they've signed. I guess you can look at it a couple of ways. I don't think this was the plan. I don't think Phil wanted to shoot for a lottery pick. I think he wanted this season to be a way to showcase the virtues of the triangle and sort of catch the attention of the rest of the league, and more important, free agents who might look at what the Knicks are doing under Phil and say, hey, that's a place I might want to play. But clearly it hasn't worked out that way. And I think Phil has gone to plan B of completely just gutting the roster and saying, you know, you got to start over in the summer. And I think it's an accumulation of a lot of bad personnel moves that date back years.
Right.
That have kind of led to this. I mean, I don't think you can blame Phil for a lot of this. I think you can question the Tyson Chandler trade in hindsight, even though at the time it seemed like a perfectly reasonable deal to trade him for Jose Calderon, who hasn't had his best year. But I think at this point, he saw the writing on the wall and said, you know what, you just got to blow this whole thing up. I'm going to collect as much cap space as I can and go from there.
Right. I mean, the Tyson Chandler trade looks really bad right now, but at the time it was
Yeah.
three. I mean, you can't, it's so hard to judge these trades, you know, in real time because it's always evolving. But at the time of the deal, most people said, okay, like you probably might have maybe wanted more for Tyson Chandler, but he's coming off a bad year. He's getting older. There's no guarantee he's going to be the guy that he used to be. And okay, like, hey, wow, a Knicks trade that actually kind of makes sense. And, you
Yeah,
know, so it blew up.
and I think also people forget that I can't remember how many years he had left on his deal, but obviously a major factor in making that trade was getting rid of Ray Felton
Right.
and his contract. They wanted to clear that off the books for future seasons. So, you know, I mean, Tyson had it was an expiring contract for Tyson. It wouldn't have. There was nothing. If it was just a straight up trade that involved Tyson, yeah, you kill them. But you know, they got rid of they got rid of Ray Felton and his deal. And how much? I don't know. I mean, it's impossible to know for sure how much of a difference Tyson really makes this season. You know, they're better than a 5-win team at this point. But how good would they really be? It's hard to know.
Right, like an 8-win team. I mean, it's not
Yeah, you
like,
know, does it really matter at
right.
that point? I mean, so this is going to be a long process. This is not going to. There are no quick fixes. You can't build a team overnight. You certainly can't build a team through free agency in one summer. So I think this summer for them is going to be fascinating to see who they get to buy in, whether there are any huge surprises, some of the top-tier guys, whether they are wooed by this. I mean, the big challenge is who wants to come here and play for the Knicks, given their sort of lackluster history, and who wants to play with Carmelo. So it'll be kind of fascinating to watch.
Right. I mean, so one of the things about this league that I think is changing is the notion that, well, free agents will only go to the big markets, they'll only go to the coast. I think that's partly true in some respects. I think a team like, say, Milwaukee has to work harder to get a free agent. But I think this next generation of guys is of players is really looking more at situations than
Yeah.
at, you know, ooh, New York, I can get my name out. Like, you can get your name out anywhere in this day and age.
Totally,
And I think,
totally.
you know, people like bemoan the AAU thing or whatever, but these guys have come up together. Like, they know each other. Some of this stuff runs deep. I mean, I was talking to a guy last year who was convinced that if Kevin Love got to really want to go to Oklahoma City because he and Russell Westbrook are so tight, you know, which just
Yeah.
runs totally counter to the narrative that we've heard all the time. And I don't, you know, who knows what they would have done given a choice. But the New York free agent thing. I mean, 2010 when they got Amare should have just totally explained in very stark terms what the reality is here with these guys.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at 2010, that was what was left. Amari, what was left after the whole LeBron sweepstakes, and Amari gave the team a couple of good seasons, but his knee issues were well known by then. They signed to a huge deal, and it's really, I mean, it hindered them last season, last free agency. They had no cap space because of Amari. And you know, guys like Bargnani, that was maybe one of the worst deals in NBA history.
Take that, Masai Ujiri.
Yeah, I mean, that's a deal that's going to continue to haunt them. I mean, Phil's got enough trouble. I mean, you think about it, Bargnani's done after this year. But the Knicks' 2016 first round pick still belongs to the Raptors because of that deal. I mean, the ghost of Bargnani is still going to be haunting this team in future drafts. And that's sort of handcuffing Phil as well. I mean, a lot of these challenges that Phil is facing are clearly the work of previous regimes. But this is what he signed up for, and they're paying him handsomely to get out of this predicament.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I just don't even know. I think your point is a really important one. Like, guys, the whole allure of playing in New York, I think it's overrated. I think nowadays, I mean, these players get so much visibility and commercial opportunities no matter where they go. they don't need to be in New York for this stuff. It is a major market. There are advantages. But I do think most players who are elite free agents want to win and are at stages in their career where they want to, like, pair up with guys who can help them win. So you have to fill to convince guys that they can play together and win here despite not much precedent
right.
For success. But I mean, really, I mean, Phil's going to rely on his own name rather than the name of the Knicks to sort of persuade these guys to come here.
It's weird too, because, like, I don't think a lot of guys in this day and age grew up being like, ooh, I can't wait to play for Phil Jackson, team president.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I mean, and it's
almost a generation too late.
Right.
You know, it's not like his, I mean, I think guys know who he is and know his legacy, but, you know, they grew up watching Jordan. They didn't really grow up watching Phil. You know, it's not like they played against Phil coach teams. A lot of these free agents are young guys. But I think you're right. I mean, how much resonance does it really have? It's going to have, but that's why I think Phil wanted this year to go better than it has, because he wanted to have something tangible that he could point at. Okay? Like, look at what this team did despite not having top level talent. We made the playoffs, you know. You could come here and look, just imagine the possibilities. Well, it hasn't worked out that way. They're 5-32. So he can't really say, like, look at how great the triangle is that really worked well with Carmelo. It hasn't. They're basically imploded. So he's going to have to kind of be inventive in how he pitches this to guys.
Got to ask about Melo here. Did they want him back? It sounds weird to say when he signs a, whatever it was, 100-something million contract, but, like, this would seem to be a lot easier without him.
Yeah, that's the big question, right? You know, I've talked to some people, and there are only so many elite scorers in the league. You know, he's one-dimensional. Yeah. I still remain convinced that if you get the right guys around Carmelo, he could be a good team player. I don't know why. Maybe that's just blind faith. I don't know. I still think it can work with him. There are only so many guys who have his level of skill in the league. So, yeah, I mean, it is what it is at this point. I hate to say that, but he's got to kind of work with it. In hindsight, would they have done this? I don't know. Would you have?
way to pass the buck, Scott.
I have no idea. I mean, it's such a hard question to answer.
It really is. It really is. I mean, I've gone back and forth on Melo over the years. I mean, I thought I was right there with all the analytics guys, you know, saying, oh, he's overrated and all this kind of stuff. And that one year when they actually put together a team that complimented him in all facets, and Tyson played out of his mind defensively, and everybody played really well, and they hit upon that small lineup and everything worked well, it's like, wow, you know, you can get a 54-win team with him as the focal point. Maybe that gets you to the second round of the conference finals. Maybe it doesn't win you a championship, but you can actually do this. And so I've kind of come around on him. I kind of agree with you that he is such a talented player, and he is such a focal point offensively, that if you built the right team around him, but it's really hard to do that.
It's really hard. It's really, really hard. It's funny, before I started covering the Knicks, I got the chance to go to the Olympics in London.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds terrible. I mean, there's really no value to making this point, but I'm going to make it anyway. But if you look at him on that team, he was so good. He was so good because his only role was just let other guys draw attention and make shots. That's all he did. He just stood on the perimeter and made shots. He
right.
was awesome in the Olympics. You know, but you need other players. I mean, if you could get guys who could create, just a couple of guys who could create around him and weren't necessarily shoot-first guys. I mean, how much value is there really to J.R. Smith as your number two? Does he really create that much for other guys? He's a good passer when he wants to be, but he wasn't totally a sort of shoot-first mentality guy. I mean, what's the value of having him on the court with Carmelo?
Mm-hmm.
It worked really well for a season, I guess, when they went to the playoffs in 2012-13. I think the sort of prudent approach this summer for Phil would be not necessarily to target those top line guys who probably aren't going anywhere anyway. And you look at guys like, you know, it sounds terrible. Like, you know, there's like this second tier group of free agents that maybe you target, like Wesley Matthews. A lot of these guys are restricted too.
If you can,
you know, Paul Millsap, Goran Dragic would be great if they could get him. I love his game.
Mm-hmm.
And these are guys who are not making $18, $19 million a year. So you have to go for maybe the second tier guys and build a team that way. You kind of look at the Hawks as an example of how they kind of built slowly with cohesiveness, and they kept personnel together. So I think that's – everybody kind of wants this big splashy free agent signing, but that hasn't really worked out for the Knicks in the past. So maybe they're better off going on a more low-key approach.
Oh, I think so, for sure. And I mean, it's interesting. Like, the 2015 class doesn't have, like, the superstar guys. But, like, I don't know, man. Like, you look at guys like Kawhi Leonard, Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green, and, like, I know some of those guys are restricted. They're good, really good players. And there's a phrase I've been hearing around the league a little bit called people are referring to winning players, and it's kind of hard to quantify, I guess. But, you know, it's guys who make an impact on winning games, which isn't necessarily scoring points or even accumulating stats. Like, look at what Draymond Green is doing. Like, every night he's putting together, you know, a complete game on both ends of the court. And those guys, I think, with the new cap and the way the game has evolved and the way people's understanding of it have evolved, I think those are the guys that are going to be getting nice paydays in free agency. And maybe there's a place for them in New York, and maybe that's part of a winning culture. I don't know.
Get two or three of those guys together, and that's a pretty good team. If you pair those two or three guys with Carmelo, who's already here, that's not bad.
Right. What is Fisher's thing in all this? I mean, I caught up with them when they were in Boston. You weren't there, which annoyed me, but I caught up with them.
I was already off the feet at that point.
That was a great morning. You can see his demeanor during games. He's really calm, but even like talking to him, he's exceptionally calm, which is kind of freaky. Yeah. Most coaches are not calm like that.
He's really pretty sort of self-contained during games. I think he may have gotten one technical this year. I'm not positive. I think he may have been called for it. But yeah, he's really, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the weird thing about this team is I think they are trying. They're just not good. I mean, it's just, the talent just isn't there. And they've actually been, you know, close in a lot of games that they've lost late. I mean, that's what separates good teams from bad teams, is that good teams know how to win. This team can't win late. Recently, I mean, they've just been getting blown out. It's hard when you're so depleted by injury, and then you trade and or waive three rotation players on Monday. I mean, this will be interesting to see what kind of team takes the court tonight against the Wizards.
I think that's the theme for the Knicks. They are trying, they're just not good.
So what's, I mean, yeah, and I think for Fisher, what good does like screaming do?
You know,
it's not really his personality. I think he's probably being true to himself. It's so hard to evaluate whether he's doing a good job or a bad job just because of the personnel. I mean, who would win with this roster? You know, you feel for him though. I mean, this is first go around as a coach, and they're just getting clobbered.
Right.
And demoralizing.
And getting and you're right. I mean, I do think there's an effort there, but they're getting clobbered in a way that just got to kill a guy like Fisher, who's been around winning teams his entire professional career.
Such a change for him.
Yeah.
Personally, he's never been around this before. It's also interesting. I wonder if, you know, Jason Kidd's doing pretty well in Milwaukee now, and he kind of turned things around last season in Brooklyn. I wonder if more sort of executives will be reluctant to hire a player immediately and put him as a coach. I think experience is important. I mean, I think, you know, if you talk to some coaches, being an assistant under a really good coach, it's just different than being a player. Even if you're a point guard, it's sort of a coach on the floor, it's a totally different role. I do think that the value of being an assistant coach and maybe being a head coach at a different level of basketball really does have value. And I wonder if this will have a cooling effect. Fisher's struggles this year, if that has a cooling effect on maybe other teams being willing to hire a player and make him a coach immediately.
I have two words for you on that. Steve Kerr.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But That is true. But he didn't jump immediately from playing to coaching either. I mean, it's sort of around the league in other capacities, right? And he was a GM.
Right. He didn't go right from the court to the sideline like some of these guys. Yeah. And I mean, I think there's definitely I think you make a lot of good points there. I don't know that there is a coaching formula. I mean, like, I was really impressed with what Steve Clifford did last year, lifelong assistant coach. Hey, let's hire those guys. I've been around Brad Stevens quite a bit, and, you know, you're not seeing it yet, but I think that you will in time, that he is probably a pretty good coach, came from college. Hey, maybe we should give college guys a shot again. You know, it's like, it's so random. I mean, it's all based on talent, number one, but who succeeds and who doesn't can be very, very rare. Frank Vogel was like a video coordinator. You know, and he's Spoelstra, same thing. Like, so I don't know that there is a coach mold. And if there was, you darn sure that some of these owners would be, you know, trying to patent it.
And there's so many variables to judging what, if a coach is a good coach too. I mean, it's impossible. How do we know if Brett Brown is a really good coach?
Right.
I think he probably is a really good coach, but what does he have to work with there? Not much. He's trying to squeeze as much as he can out of those guys. So you're right. I mean, this is the hand that Fisher was dealt. He's got to work through this season. In a way, maybe it's good. This is kind of like a training run for him. He can make all the mistakes he needs to make this season because it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. And you hope that this experience will help him next year.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit here and go to something a little more pleasant, because poor Scott has been so beleaguered by the NBA that he has to go do something else. But one story you did this year, which I really enjoyed, was you caught up with a kid named Brady Heslip in the D League, who was lighting it up, playing. He was playing for the team that's run the Grinnell style, right?
Yeah, it's the whole Kings crazy experimental offense.
Right, which I'm not really thrilled about this development in the D-League, by the way.
Yeah, I think it's tough. I mean, for all the numbers that Brady's putting up this year, most people view it, the system that they're running, as a novelty. And it's like, it's hard to really evaluate players who play in that system because it's so unlike anything actual NBA teams run. So they don't play defense. I mean, they're by design. They want to get a shot off within the first 8 seconds of the shot clock. So they don't really run anything. He's not working off a ton of screens necessarily. So it's really hard to gauge, how he would fit in, to an actual real live NBA offense. But the story was fun to do just because he's putting up video game numbers, and it's crazy, especially early on in the season. He was just putting up crazy, crazy shooting. He was shooting like 60% for three for his first 10 games or something like that.
Right.
Amazing.
Right. I love doing D-League stuff. I did a number of years ago. I hung out with the Maine Red Claws for like 3-4 days, and it's so much different than the NBA because, like, the guys there have very little to do in their downtime, so they can't wait to tell you their life story.
The access is great.
The access is unbelievable. I mean, there are a lot of great stories there. But I think a lot of them sort of like always then wind up coming back to, you know, it's, it's just really hard to go from being a D-League guy to getting a shot. And there's a number of examples, but for every example we can come up with, there's 10 other guys who never got the opportunity. So what's Brady's story? What's he doing now?
So he was in training camp with the Timberwolves, I think. And I think he was one of their last cuts there. And so he latched on in Reno. I guess the thing that's probably holding him back is his size. I mean, he's not a big shooting guard. And then defensively, who's he going to guard in the NBA? You really need to pair him with a large point guard. So Brady would guard a point guard, and his teammate would take on somebody taller. I really articulated that well, didn't I?
Very timesian.
Anyway, I'm saying Brady's small. So that's the problem. I think offensively, I really believe that he wouldn't have a problem getting his own shot in the NBA. I mean, he's got the quickest release. And the guys who are defending him in the D League are pretty good athletes. They're often much taller than he is, and he still doesn't have a he's shooting 40. So I'm looking up his stats right now. He's shooting 48.9% from three this season. He's taken a ton of threes, and he's averaging 26 points a game in 30 minutes. So still pretty crazy numbers through 14 games. Is that a small sample size, or would you consider 14 games a pretty good indication?
It's pretty small, but yeah. Clearly the kid can shoot and he can score. But it's funny, like D-League stats are kind of strange, and not for the reason people think. People think it's a bad league or whatever. It's not, as you know from being around it. It's just that they don't have the 7 foot guys. If they did have the 7 foot guys, they'd be in the NBA. Whether they could walk and chew gum at the same time is totally irrelevant. So you have a lot of like three guard alignments, or even six forwards playing power forward, 6'8" centers. So it's like really good college, but better, you know? So it's, those stats can be kind of hard to quantify as far as I know. I don't know if anyone's actually done any like real work on that.
That's interesting. Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that, but I think it's absolutely true. Guys get a lot of there just aren't that many rim protectors in the D League for guys to get layups, and the paint is kind of is open game.
Right. There's one other story you did that I want to talk about in the time we have left. So earlier this year, at a Brooklyn Nets game, I believe, was when the I Can't Breathe t-shirts that Derrick Rose wore, and then they made their way into the arena for the Brooklyn Nets game. You wrote a TikTok the next day for the Times about this. It's a fascinating story. I'm curious how that came about. A little inside journalism for people who care about such things. I mean, you're at the arena, I guess. It's not like you were tipped off to this story, right? Or how did this work?
Yeah, no, I didn't know what was happening until, we were in the Cavs locker room pregame, and we saw that LeBron had one of the shirts in his locker. So that's when people kind of knew that he was going to wear one for warm-ups, and he was joined by several other players. So that kind of happened, and I wasn't even really writing about it that night. But the next morning, we were trying to think about how to follow up on that story, because we thought it was news that NBA players were taking Derrick Rose's cue and picking up expressing their social views in such a public way. It was fascinating. So we just thought it would be interesting to find out how they got the shirts, whether there was a process to it, who gave them the shirts, whose idea it was it LeBron? So it was a while ago. I'm trying to think exactly what the first call I made was. I went to Nets practice the next morning, and I talked to Jarrett Jack, who had worn one of the shirts. And he told me that he had requested them from his agent. And his agency had been able to get him a few T-shirts, and he was able to get a few of them into the Cavs locker room for the game, because he used to play for the Cavs. He's friends with Kyrie. And so he actually, Jarrett Jack actually provided the Cavs with their shirt. But the issue was that the Nets had their own shirt. So there actually were two streams of t-shirts that made their way to players that night. There were the Jarrett Jack shirts, and then there were the Nets shirts. And the Nets shirts was really interesting because it was a bunch of people were involved. It was a group called, I'm going to butcher their name. I don't have it in front of me, but it's the Social Justice League.
The Justice League, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Justice League of New York. And they've been really sort of vocal and important in a lot of the protests in the city after the Eric Garner decision.
Mm-hmm.
They had staged a lot of the protests. So they had sort of reached out to, once they saw what Derrick Rose had done in Chicago a few nights earlier, they had reached out to, through back channels, to Jay-Z to see if Jay-Z could get in touch with players who were going to be involved in this game, the Nets-Cavs game. The Justice League of New York viewed it as a really public way for them to get this message out because the Duke and Duchess, or the Prince and, were they? I don't even know what they're called. Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Prince William and Kate were going to be in the game. Jay-Z was going to be in the game. It was a huge, there was so much attention on this game that the Justice League wanted these shirts on players. So they reached out to Jay-Z. Jay-Z got in touch with a couple of the Nets, Darren Williams, and they were able to, this organization was able to get the shirts into the arena by finding a friendly security guard who got the shirts into the Nets locker room. So it was really kind of a complicated, it's amazing when you think about it, like it shouldn't be that hard to get like a player a t-shirt.
Right.
But it turned into this whole convoluted, frantic sprint to get these shirts to the players in the moments before the game. And I think the Nets only basically got the shirts maybe a half hour before they took the court for warm-ups. So there was a lot more to the story than I anticipated there would be, which kind of made it interesting. But yeah, it was fun to actually do the reporting and make all these calls, and it just happened to work out.
Well, hopefully we're going to see more stories like that from you in the future, Scott, and less, you know, I don't know, Cole Aldrich features, I guess. No offense to Cole Aldrich. I'm sure he's a fine fellow. But Scott Cassiola from the Times, basketball writer, and now basketball writer without really a home base, which I think is going to be a great experience for you and great for the readers as well. Scott, thanks so much for being the first guest. Sorry for the technical difficulties we had today. Thanks for bearing with me. And yeah, you are the man. You were the first podcast guest of this season.
I'm honored. It's a privilege.
You should be. All right, Scott Cassiola, thanks again, buddy. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
All right.